And we're back with an all-new Keep It. I'm Ira.
I'm Aida. See? Beat you this time, guys.
Oh, my God. I feel emasculated. I'm Louis Vertel.
Hello.
I saw Aida in the wild last night.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You guys were at the Troubadour.
Aida. My first time at the Troubadour. What a beautiful venue. Like, what a cute, intimate environment.
Yeah. It was nice seeing something there that wasn't like Carly Rae Jepsen or Kim Petras.
Yeah. It's such a haunted place because literally, like, for instance, John Lennon was thrown out of the Troubadour during a Smothers Brothers show once. It's just one of those storied LA places where, like, Linda Ronstadt became famous and
Elton John. Mm-hmm, yeah. His, like, American shows were there. They're featured in Rocket Man.
Okay.
But we were there to see our friend, my friend Vincent, who is a.
Who was amazing.
Beautiful
amazing
voice.
Yeah. And I discovered Vincent from Ira's story. And then at the same week, my friend was like, my friend who I went to Berkeley with is having a show. Do you want to come? And then I went and it was Vincent.
Yeah.
So it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect.
Amazing voice. Great vocals.
I'm
People
fed.
Should listen to him.
I'm so fed.
If you have not, you're fed.
From that night, the girls were eating. Eating.
Speaking of the girls, we neglected last week, I think, to touch on Natalie Portman's dress.
Right.
And her dress at the Oscars was a subtle tribute to female filmmakers who did not get recognition at the Oscars this year. So she had, you know, Lulu Wang, Celine Sciamma,
Greta Gerwig.
Yeah, you know. And it was just a small part of her gown, so you really sort of had to look.
Wasn't it like a cape?
Yeah.
Like a cape attachment?
There was a cape attachment, and, like, you know, it was very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
However, it didn't go over well with some people.
Mm-hmm.
First, of course, it was some people on social media trying to call out Natalie for not having worked with that many female directors.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those people, of course, was town crier Rose McGowan, who said, I find Portman's type of activism deeply offensive to those of us who actually do the work. I'm not writing this out of bitterness. I am writing out of disgust. Just so you know.
I guess my feeling is it would be more hypocritical to me if she had worn that cape 20 years ago and then only worked with male directors. But we all realize now that there's this huge problem that needs to be corrected, so I don't really see the harm in her wearing it.
Yeah, and Rose continued with, I just want her and other actresses to walk the walk, and called it...
Who's to say she's not?
Yeah.
I called it the kind of protest that gets rave reviews from the mainstream media for its bravery and... Imagine how tired Rose is.
Right.
You don't have to imagine. She tells you.
Like you said, Louis, I feel like it's not fair to fault her for not working with male directors. I think the other thing that Rose was critiquing her on was not hiring women who were executives at her company, at her production company. Maybe I think that she's more culpable for that.
Mm-hmm.
Not the first thing.
But Natalie's response was she stated that the past few years have seen a blossoming of directing opportunities for women due to the collective efforts of many people who have been calling out the system. The gift has been these incredible films. I hope that what was intended as a simple nod to them does not distract from their great achievements. And responding to Rose's claim specifically, she said, it's true I've only made a few films with women. In my long career, I've only gotten the chance to work with female directors a few times. I've made shorts, commercials, music videos, and features with Myra Cohen, Mira Nair, Rebecca Sladkowski, Anna Holmer, Sofia Coppola, Shirin Neshat, and herself. Unfortunately, the unmade films I have tried to make are a ghost history. As she goes into the fact that she's had the experience of helping get female directors hired on projects and then they were forced out because of working conditions or other female-directed films facing scrutiny, you know, getting into festivals, getting distribution, and getting accolades from other gatekeepers. And there are actually reports of other movies she'd been signed on with that initially had female directors who had to exit for some reason or another. And I think part of the conversation is it's hard to get female directors work.
Yeah.
Even when you're Natalie Portman, you know? And so I don't think it's been lack of trying on her part.
Yeah, I also... I mean, like, how much was she supposed to do single-handedly as an actress over the years to make female directors occur? I mean, like, exactly. The problem is that there aren't enough, right? Or we don't encourage them to enter the industry, or there's not opportunities for them, you know. So, but yeah. it seems like now Natalie Portman's really in a position to be proactive about it.
Yeah. Also, at the Oscars, the only person who was still, I mean, actively having that conversation was Natalie Portman, at least in a very visible way. So it makes me ask the question of when can you start protest? Like, when can a person, regardless of their history, start protest? Do you need to have an entirely clean slate? That doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
She seems pretty egoless about being called out, though. So, I feel like that's part of being a celebrity in 2020 or whatever. Like, for instance, Jane Fonda's protest, still garnering some criticism from people who claim it's stunty or whatever. But, you know, it's like, who cares? Good. Take the hit and keep going. Keep doing it.
I think we'll get into that a bit when we talk later about some activism from a one Jameela Jamil.
Uh-huh.
We will be getting into that entire hotbed of a debate. We will also be talking about Bloomberg spending millions on memes.
Beautiful.
Because that's a thing you do now in 2020.
And teens love it. Do it for them.
We will also be having a conversation with Heather Graham.
Legend.
Yeah. So we will be right back. Have you all noticed your Instagram being terrorized with Bloomberg memes?
Unfortunately, yes.
All of my screens. I can't watch Jeopardy without hearing from this bastard.
Is he in the final answer?
Yeah, he's hiding in the clues. Yeah.
I'll take Bloomberg for 500.
Million.
Yeah. You're seeing all these memes because alleged Democratic candidate Mike Bloomberg has tapped some of the biggest meme makers on the internet, which means people who drive me insane.
Yeah, right.
To post sponsored content on Instagram to promote his presidential campaign. He has spent $1 million a day on this endeavor the past week, which is further calling into question the morality and fairness of his campaign.
Yeah. I think I'm also just ready to cancel memes. I think this is peak memes, and we're done with them
now. I feel like we don't do memes anymore. We do, like, reaction images, funny photos, but I don't like memes, like, white. Stop. Stop. just stop. Like,
the lesson is, he just, because of the amount of money he has, he just is reaching out to whatever. He got, like, a readout of the most popular people, knows nothing about them.
Mm-hmm.
Gets them to post a meme, and then that's it. Like, he's so rich, he doesn't even have to be creative about taking over the media.
Let's jump into the fact that the Daily Beast reported that the campaign was offering social media influencers $150 to create content in support of him. $150. This man is a billionaire who is trying to buy his way into the presidency, and you were taking $150 from him?
I would never. I would never do it.
I got $1,000 from a company to post some branded content last week. Like, and you're getting $150 from Bloomberg?
Have some more self-respect.
Yeah, he's spending $1 million a day on this stuff.
Right.
Let's think about, you can picture a pie, right?
Yeah. What's the math on that?
Picture a boysenberry in the middle of the pie. Picture a quarter of that. That's what you're getting.
So it's extra embarrassing for him to be doing this. And extra embarrassing that Instagram is letting it happen, because his SponCon on Instagram will not be subject to Facebook's political ad regulations.
That's cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So basically he's using Instagram because it is free reign. And I think we know what would happen if that were to happen on Facebook again. We saw the 2016 election.
I wonder if Instagram's probably what will happen. It'll be our Facebook fiasco again. And we'll be living in a Bloomberg presidency.
I mean, the only good thing that's coming out of this man gaining what I'll call prominence, buying his way into prominence, is it just makes me want to vote for the people I want to vote for.
Yeah.
Like, it makes me think, like, this is exactly what Elizabeth Warren hates.
Yes.
So she continues to be right.
So there was also this moment from the Bill Maher's show, ugh, the chills.
Right.
And Katie Couric was on it, and she was talking about this other tactic that Bloomberg had done.
I talked to somebody from the Bloomberg campaign. They said they're hiring an expert on narcissism and combining that. Combining that person with a comedy writer to get in Donald Trump's head.
Sure. But...
What?
What kind of witch shit is that? What does that have to do with anything?
Can we not incorporate comedy writers? Everybody on Earth is like quasi a comedy writer right now. I don't need another one like in the mix.
Did they steal them from Klobuchar's campaign?
Oh, yeah. Oh, her jokes? What's the thing she always says? Who does that?
She's the new Jerry Seinfeld.
Yeah, it's just her and Jerry.
Her upswing still needs to be explained to me. Do people like her because she's just not terribly old like the other front runners? I feel like that's what's hurting certain people in the race, right? Like, they just want somebody who's 55 or whatever.
I mean, you know I'm from Milwaukee, and I went to a all-boys Catholic high school, so I grew up with Republicans. I feel like a lot of them are, like, their spouses who are, like, more Republican or, like, their parents, they say that they would vote for, like, and Amy Klobuchar, because she's centristy. So,
oh,
like,
so
she's
just
closer to them.
The new moderate we're trying out after whomever has fled the race already, yeah. Beto, et cetera.
Yeah, her or that gay.
Yeah.
Right. No, one gay.
Huh?
After...
Did you say what?
I said one gay. What?
Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Noted homosexual running.
Other than us, like, keeping up with pop culture and having seen the memes, did you guys see them on your feeds?
I have seen them,
yeah.
But not the way that other people were seeing them, mostly because I don't follow meme accounts.
Yeah, they're blocked, actually.
I'm always disappointed in, like, for instance, the rare times, like, a tweet of mine ends up on one of those accounts, now with credit, thanks to a lot of the people who fought
yeah.
against people like
Fuck Jerry. Fuck Jerry.
I'm like, why don't you just follow these people at the source? I don't get anything out of reading material where you're supposed to say, that's me, or same.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand the joy of that, because it's such obvious comedy, like, oh, we're all big messes. Oh, we all like pizza. You know, it's just like, what? Like, yes, I eat food and go to sleep. Like, yeah. What? It's so stupid to me.
I mean, one of our friends, Jordan Ardita, he had a tweet that was like, next week is already exhausting.
Yes.
And then that just got, it was about, like, the election and about, like, things actually being exhausting and horrible. And then it kept being repurposed for, like, mommy blogger Instagram memes. It's like, oh, next week is exhausting at Kroger's.
No. I went to a hotel and Jordan's tweet was posted on the wall without credit, by the way.
Yes. And even talking about how we do get credited now when those sites take one of our tweets, this was what I talked about on the show a year or so ago when Betches, you know, the people who run Hinge as well, stole that tweet of mine and then posted it. And the thing is, even when they're giving you credit, like, they will tag your Instagram or, like, be like, get it from this at Twitter account, those pages are getting money for posting your tweet. You know, so, like, you may be getting credited, but, like, they're getting, like,
$1,000
or something.
It's not commensurate. Yeah.
You know, so, like, it's like, what is the point of these meme accounts? And imagine following, like, a Fuck Cherry. Or there's Kale Salad, which is one of those meme accounts and was also run by BuzzFeed employee Samir Mizrahi.
Mm.
And I worked with Samir when I was at BuzzFeed. Full disclosure, he used to work at BuzzFeed. and Samir is actually the person who got me at Ira on Twitter.
Oh, really?
Wow.
Oh, yeah. That's power.
He slacked me one day and was like, would you want your name to be Ira on Twitter? And I said, sure. And it was done in a day.
Oh, my creepy King Midas shit.
And yeah. Ira Glass has never slept since that day.
He shook.
Ira Gershwin's ghost rattling.
Pull up Ira's. You know the Addy. But BuzzFeed allowed Samir to post sponsored content on his Kale Salad meme account because it is part of their creators program, which permits some non-news employees to monetize their own social media channels. Facebook says that branded content is different from advertising, but in either case, we believe it's important people know when they're seeing paid content on our platforms. That's why we have an ad library where anyone can see who paid for an ad and why we require creators to disclose any paid partnerships through our branded content tools. I don't find it shocking that BuzzFeed let one of their employees post an ad for Mike Bloomberg that only paid them $150 because BuzzFeed is cheap. but that is just wild to me.
Yeah. Also, wait, are we sure that all these people just got $150? Like, if you write for BuzzFeed, you're probably offered more than that, right?
Probably, yes. The Daily Beast reported that some people were paid $150. Oh. Maybe Kale Salagar got a little more change.
Okay. Yeah.
A little more green.
Yeah. I don't think people are coming out with how much that they made from Bloomberg, obviously. And which is to say that we're now talking about Bloomberg and his fucking memes instead of, Stop and Frisk.
Right.
And his other racist policies when he was mayor.
Didn't he also say that redlining would have prevented the 2008 recession?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
And also the timeliness of this memes was right after that audio clip was leaked about him talking about Stop and Frisk.
Yes, you know, it's like, oh, let's remind people that I'm funny, and it's funny that a billionaire is trying to buy their way into the presidency, almost sort of like Trump did.
Also the memes, did you look at the memes?
Yeah.
They're really bad. Like,
they're very bad.
He's trying to appeal to the youth vote by being like painfully ironic and being an old man, and then a lot of it's like black culture jokes too. Really strange.
Well, so many of the memes are like him DMing the account saying, hey, can you post this meme? And they're like, this meme is dumb, you're old. And like, that's the point of the joke.
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to see Bloomberg on TikTok doing the Renegade next week.
Which, by the way, that has no political that has no political content in it.
None.
It's just, it's like the most sarcastic, pointless exhibitionism of his candidacy.
Right?
It's banal, and it's also just emblematic of what is so gross about, you know, sort of advertising in politics right now, too. It's like, I'm trying to appeal to younger voters by doing these memes that have no actual content in them, you know? And it's like, you have actual candidates out here trying to talk about policies and actually try to connect with younger voters. I mean, you can talk about the way, like, the Sanders campaign connects with younger voters. And this is just, it's nonsense.
And yeah, the amount of exorbitant money spending is not appealing to me. I like Elizabeth Warren, whose campaign is funded on lint and hopes, you know? That's what I appeal to.
And the energy of 4 a.m. Grindr text, blowing up my phone, asking for another donation. I'm like, I've given you enough, but I will give you more. Now that Bloomberg is posting memes.
Yeah. 150, no more, no less. That's what she gets.
I think what's uncomfortable is realizing that Mike Bloomberg is somebody you, as a Democratic voter, now have to be almost vocally against. We're still in the stage where we're supposed to be obsessed with a candidate or picking who we're voting for in the primaries. But it's like, now there's this person who you specifically have to speak up about because they've made themselves loud enough that they feel almost like a normal competitive candidate when, in fact, they run against everything the Democratic Party allegedly stands for.
Right. And, you know, it feels a lot like the Republicans might have been feeling in 2016, right? You know, with like Trump running and people not really taking him seriously until all of a sudden, he became a very big problem. And I also want to dispel the notion, too, that, like, I'm comparing Bloomberg to Trump. I think they're two different kinds of evils. One, Bloomberg actually has money. And Trump does right. not. And his family's not as gross. But I will also say that we obviously, like, make jokes about a lot of the candidates and, like, we support who we support. But, like, at the end of the day, we're also talking about supporting the Democratic Party in taking on Trump and conservatism in this country that is very detrimental to a lot of people. And Bloomberg is not that. You know, we're not talking about the fact that he changed term limits for mayor in New York so that he could have a third term and then changed them back after he was a mayor a third time. You know, it's like, this is the kind of man who is bought his way into a mayorship and is now trying to buy his way into a presidency. And I feel like we should be talking about his issues. We should be vetting him the way that we horrifically vetted, you know, people like Kamala Harris and had them dropping out of the race. And now it's like, I bet a lot of people are pissed they dropped out of the race now that Bloomberg's in it. And we're changing convention rules so that he could be like a debate too. Like,
it seems exhausting to have to read up on, be informed about somebody who is ostensibly wasting our time. But yes, he has made himself present in a way where now you have to.
Wasting his time, but also spending so much money that, as I mentioned last week, you know, like I have family members messaging me like, oh, should I be voting for Bloomberg? He seems like the only person who can beat Trump. And he probably seems like the only person who can beat Trump to them because he's the only person spending billions of dollars to be on their TV all the fucking time. And he's taking up all the oxygen, and they don't know what the other candidates can do.
Also, it gets into the conversation for me of, I know it's new waters for us to navigate, but this happened in 2016 with Facebook. Why are we not doing something preemptive and proactive about Instagram and Instagram ads and these different loopholes and maneuvers that these candidates can use? Why are we talking about it after the fact? And I know that that's going to probably happen in the future, too.
Right, because nobody's using Facebook right now.
Not at all.
I mean, I'm sure older relatives are using Facebook, and I will sometimes get a friend request from someone on Facebook. I'll be like, why?
You're alive?
We're friends on Instagram or like Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know me in LA. Why are you adding me on Facebook?
Can I tell you something? I did a bit for work recently where I had to go ask people what their last Facebook status was, and I had forgotten that no one had one. They're like, oh, I kind of occasionally will repost. Like if I go on vacation, maybe I post pictures, whatever. But really, nobody in our demographic uses it regularly anymore. I was alarmed to find it was like 0%.
Ira is watching McMillions.
Oh, I miss that.
I do miss the blank is doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I also miss, well, the number one thing I miss about Facebook is when you had your favorite books, movies, whatever listed, and always in college under favorite books, the you'd look up your crush, and it would fill in with "don't read."
I forgot about that.
Like how proud they were,
or it'd be like Slaughterhouse-Five,
or 1984, yeah, and that's it.
Right, yeah.
Those two books, and that's it.
It's like we get it, Orwell and Vonnegut,
the Great American Novels.
You went to school.
I specifically had a crush in college who I went to his Facebook because that was where there were no Twitters or whatever then. You didn't get constant updates on people. You had to look at their Facebook interests to see what was happening with them or their wall or whatever. And his favorite book was R.L. Stein's The Goosebumps.
Wow. I do love The Goosebumps and such.
Yeah. Tales of The Goosebumps.
You guys haven't talked about The Goosebumps since I got here. And you used to talk about it a lot.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. A lot.
You've been listening to all the episodes?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Doing her research?
Keeping it.
What do you want me to say about Goosebumps?
I don't know. Talk about it more.
My hairiest adventure still slays.
Yeah.
It came from beneath the sink. Bullshit.
I met this boy at a party on Friday. Well, it turns out I'd already met him before, and I just kept forgetting his name.
In what kind of capacity?
But he was wearing a Curse of the Mummy's Tomb shirt. That's Goosebumps number 5.
Oh, and do we like him for it?
Yeah.
Be careful what you wish for. That was a good one.
Ooh, I think that was number 12.
Yeah, something. Yeah.
12. Yeah, mm-hmm. That one had the crystal ball on it and like the girl looking scared on it. I could sometimes pull back numbers of Goosebumps books, mostly because I read them when
in
I was
sequence,
a kid.
As the author intended?
Well, like yes, I read them in sequence, but also like my school, grade school, was like obsessed with the Goosebumps books. So when they came out, I used to go right after school to get the new one.
As
and then I would read it that night, but then I would still bring it to school with me so people could see that I had the new
Bitch had to flex.
Book. Yeah.
You had to flex.
Flexing on you with piano lessons can be murder.
I remember at my house, this is very important to the Bloomberg conversation, I know, but we had a copy of Let's Get Invisible.
Yeah.
And I remember
number 6.
Yes. And
Please tell me it's not based off like Olivia Newton-John song.
No. Let's get physical. Yes.
Let's get visible.
Wow. Is that supposed to be a pun on that?
No.
Okay. It better not be.
Maybe.
No, it has to be. That doesn't make any sense. Let's get invisible.
Yeah. It sounds really hokey.
I want to see your body gone.
Works out. But I was very young then, and I was kind of afraid of the cover. I remember Goosebumps books, I couldn't be in the room.
The covers were creepy.
Yeah.
And that was actually one of the scarier books.
Yeah, right.
Then they got silly. Like, nobody is afraid of vampire's breath.
No, right. That's when the covers got even hokier. They were like cartoonish looking.
Or it came from beneath the sink.
That's right.
Yeah.
The Scarecrow Walks at Midnight, I enjoyed that one.
Yeah.
These still sound like Olivia Newton-John songs.
That would be from her Nashville days. Yeah.
Yes, it's from the album Twist of Fate. Anyway.
Bloomberg,
don't vote for him.
No. Yeah.
Please.
Can we please be done with this? Jesus, it hurts.
Block Fuck Jerry and Kale Salad. And...
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, Fuck Jerry can never make enough amends. Please be done with that.
Yeah. From it, and isn't it the fat Jewish too?
Yeah.
Still
posting
things.
Oh, can't wait till his Kennedy Center honors.
Anyway, when we're back, a conversation with Heather Graham. Really exciting to have you here, Heather.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like we've all sort of admired you for years.
Yes.
Truly. I mean...
No, because I was going through your filmography, and I have a pretty acute memory when it comes to movies. And then other things came up. I was like, right, 6 degrees of separation, like Mrs. Parker and the Vicious Circle. These are movies like I was obsessed with growing up that, like, frankly, make you gay.
Yeah.
So congrats on being woven into my DNA.
Wait, do you have a boyfriend? I want to set you up with my friend.
Oh, God, I don't. No.
I love this interview already.
Yep. You may stay. Yes.
No, thinking about that, I mean, I feel like from high school, I was weirdly obsessed with, like, Boogie Nights, you know, and that was one of your first major appearances, and that's sort of what got me in the PTA, I feel like, too, and it took me a minute to get back into him, because I loved those kind of movies from him.
The seedier
sort of part. What's that been like, you know, having that as your sort of... introduction to Hollywood really as like your legacy?
I mean, I feel so lucky that I got to work with such a talented filmmaker, and it was really special, all those people sort of in a pretty beginning moment with their careers, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman. It was really special. I feel so lucky.
And it was weird because when we were looking up stuff to talk to you about, I saw that you had to turn down Heather's.
I had a very religious family. I was actually living at home. I was, I think, 17, and they're like, "If you do this movie, we're kicking you out."
Wow. How old were you when you had License to Drive?
17. Wow. It was around the same time, the same year or whatever. And then I graduated. Then I did Drugstore Cowboy after I moved out.
Yeah.
Then, because my parents read the script and they were like, "No, you're not." They were. My dad is very Catholic. No, that's sad. I look back and go, "I wish I was in that," but what can you do?
Yeah, I mean...
I guess I could have moved out. That was really a great thing about having money when you were set. Like, because I did License to Drive and I got some money. It's pretty amazing to be 17 years old and make, like, a chunk of change.
Yeah. Wow. Also, like, I feel like the variety of films you've been in has been pretty staggering. Before we started recording, we brought up Bowfinger. Can you describe what the most fulfilling type of movie-making experience is? Like, you being on a set, what's, like, the most ideal... way to spend your time making a movie?
Well, I mean, I think it all starts with a script. If you have a great script and you feel really inspired, I think, too, what it's about also matters. And the people that you're working with, the director, the other actors, I think sometimes you just get a sense you're doing something special. And, you know, to be honest, it's fun to be working as an actor. I mean, I'm just so grateful that I get to work as an actor, make money. Like, I recently started directing and writing, and I just feel so lucky to be in this business and producing. I started producing too. It's lucky to do what we do. It's not a sucky job, you know.
Yeah. That transition into your directorial debut with Half Magic, you know, how was having the experience of being an actress and being on set and knowing what you don't like from directors, how did that affect how you directed your movie?
Well, to be honest, the main thing that motivated me was just the fact that I think most movies are from a male point of view. And I just thought, you know, I want to see more movies from a female point of view. So I could sit here complaining about it, or I could just do something about it, which it's exciting to see more female directors. But I do feel like our culture just skews so heavily towards sort of like a white male perspective. And I think that it's good to show other people's points of view.
Also, well, in putting this movie together, you incorporated a lot of experiences from your life that are what I would guess are like debilitatingly sexist or horrible dating experiences.
Yeah.
Now, in committing those to the page, I always have this question about incorporating real life experiences into movies. There's something about when you write it into a movie, like your lived in personal experience feels, I don't know, like when you watch a movie, everything is elevated, everything is heightened. So I feel like certain horrible experiences made us come off as a normal movie when you write them down. Was it like very tough to put these things on the page? Was it like vulnerable making for you?
I mean, I think it is tough, but it also feels cathartic. And I just wanted to, I wish I knew when I was younger what I know now, you know, as a woman in the culture. Like, I didn't really find my own voice until I got older and I realized that I could say the things I was thinking. I just thought I had to kind of people please men, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, get them to hire me. And I hope they think I'm pretty. And I hope they think I'm sexy. I didn't realize I could just be like, this is me. I can say what I think. I really only realized that in the past, you know, recent time.
Is that true?
Well, I think I gradually, slowly became more and more like that. But just to realize that I can just be myself, I think I think as a woman in the culture, I think I grew up a little bit people-pleasy. And you just kind of feel like you're supposed to take care of everyone else all the time. And so to kind of break out of that and just go, no, I can just be myself, take care of myself first. Of course, I want to be a good person to the people around me, but just that I can be exactly who I am and say what I think.
Well, thinking of that, I mean, we brought up, you know, like even Boogie Nights or like The Spy Who Shagged Me, you know, like do you look back then on films like those with still a memorable sort of experience?
Of course. No, I feel like so lucky. I mean, to come from suburban L.A. and have nobody in the entertainment business and to be able to work in movies with my heroes. It's just, it's a huge, it's so exciting and I feel so lucky. It's more of like a broad scope, even as an audience member, not necessarily that I think anything bad about it. The men I work with, I think they're amazing and I love them and I think they're so talented. It's just like as an audience member going to movies and feeling like so many movies are so formulaic and so male, like it's just frustrating sometimes as a woman.
Mm-hmm. What's sort of been inspiring you in film lately then?
Well, I liked that movie, The Farewell.
Fabulous.
Love yes. that. Yeah, Lulu Wang is fantastic.
Yeah, I wanted her to get some awards or something.
Yeah, she got the spirit.
I know, she did? Okay, that's good, good. We were just talking in the elevator. I love Pen 15. It's not a movie, but it's these two, you know, comedians, and they're pretending like they're in middle school, but I love just this female perspective on this awkward years of growing up.
There's something about Pen 15 too, where it almost makes me mad that we haven't had that show before. Just like, why aren't we like don't have plenty of shows where we're playing our former selves and how ridiculous we were? It just it's so novel and so overdue in a way.
Well, it's like there's the scenes of her where she's learning how to masturbate, and I just think, you know, you're not used to seeing women go through that. You're used to seeing men and like whatever their different experiences with their sexuality, but her like in her room trying to figure out how to masturbate. And there's a scene where she's licking the poster of the guy that she has
a crush on. Such a clever maneuver to use them as adults because you can't show 13-year-olds doing that. Yeah. So it's smart. I love that show a lot.
I also just think in general, nostalgia in movies, like movies about like your child or whatever, those specifically skew super male. I was just watching on the plane on the way here, American Graffiti, which they're like the Wonder Years. There are so many things, Stand By Me. Like there's a whole culture of like, can you believe how much fun it was when we were 15 and wearing our jeans and
but
we had our secret
men.
Handshakes?
Yeah.
And it's like what you're nostalgic for is boys hanging around boys.
Yeah.
Speaking of like a Pen 15, do you miss the sitcom world?
I mean, there's certain sitcoms I love, that, like Friends, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when I'm on a plane, I'll watch it. It just makes me so happy.
Yeah.
But I actually prefer single camera comedies. Like, I prefer, like, Sex and the City.
Yeah. But you were on.
You were on. Yeah.
I was on. I was obsessed with that show. I thought that show was very important for women, too, because it was all about, like, feel good about yourself. Mm-hmm. You don't just need to get married and have kids, but you can be this fabulous kind of single person, just having a fun life.
Yeah. I mean, and you had a show briefly, too.
I did, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you have a fun time doing Emily?
It was fun. I mean, now that I've gotten more into writing, I think I am working on pitching a show of something that I wrote. And so that sounds really fun. I think it's so exciting now, some of the shows that are out there and how creative people are getting in TV.
Can you tell us a bit how you came to The Rest of Us? Like, how'd you link up with the director?
They sent me the script and offered me the role, and it was a really excellent script. And it's great. We went to Toronto with the film. We were in the Toronto Film Festival, and it was exciting to work with a lot of women.
Such as?
Well, the director, Aisling Chin-Yi, the two producers who form Babe Nation, Katie Bird Nolan, Lindsay Tapscott, and Jodie Balfour is the other actress, Abigail Panowski, and Sophie Nalisse. And they're all so good. I showed up on set one day, and I thought, these other actresses are bringing it. Like, I better bring it, too. Like, I'm really impressed by them.
Yeah. Do you find it difficult when you're, I mean, this goes back again to being in Half Magic and now this movie, The Rest of Us. Is it difficult for you to be in stories that are about women empowerment? Like, I'm sure that hits home for you. How is the acting different than when you're in, like, a comedy or a drama that has nothing to do with that?
Well, I guess you care more about it because you're like, I want these stories to start making money, you know, so people make more. But yeah, movie's a little bit darker. It's a little bit, it has humor, but it's a little bit more dramatic. I think Half Magic was more, hopefully, like, feel good. But yeah, it feels really good as a woman when you're working with other women and, you know, telling a story that you think, you hope is somewhat empowering to women.
Were there other women just in your career that you ran into, whether they were actresses or screenwriters, producers, who sort of planted the seed in you? Like, oh yeah, I can do this.
Well, I was always inspired by Drew Barrymore when she was producing her own stuff, Selma Hayek when she did Frida. Of course, Reese Witherspoon is amazing. I've tried to option some of those books that she's already optioned, but she has amazing taste in books.
Mm-hmm. I feel like she just wanders Barnes & Noble's just grabbing
book. I tried to option Wild. I tried to option Gone Girl. I tried to option Where the Crawdads Sing. It was like, Reese already got there. But so I joined her book club now. I tried to option Erotic Stories for Punjabi Widows, but that was Ridley Scott's company got that. But yeah, it's great to see them. I also get inspired by Frankie Shaw, how she wrote and directed her own show. Issa Rae, I thought she's a badass. People like that. Mm-hmm. And the Pen 15 girls, I feel like they created their own show. That's pretty amazing.
Even just sort of like explain to our listeners too, when you talk about like you find a story, like a book that you really like optioning it, like what's even the process of that?
Well, it's pretty scary because you're going, well, is this person gonna, when I option The Hypnotist's Love Story, I'm like, will Leanne Moriarty take me seriously? Will she let me option her book? And she did. And then you really feel behold, like you're just, I really want to do well for this person because she gave me this shot. And it's hard because people are like, well, you know, what else have you done? And if you're not as experienced as a producer, you have to prove yourself.
Right. Yeah. So how do you convince those people?
Well, luckily, some people you can't convince. There's some books I've tried to option you. I haven't been able to convince them. But with her, she gave me a shot. And she's really, you know, we have it for another year. So knock on wood, it looks like hopefully we can get it to happen. But you really want to do her right. Because I've read every book. And I just love Leanne Moriarty so much. I just feel like I know her even though I don't. And I just want to do right by Leanne, you know?
I mean, that's sort of the beauty of what we all do, right? I mean, right. I feel like we welcomed you in here, but we also felt like we knew you.
Yeah. When you see someone's work. Yeah, totally.
What kind of roles do you find yourself being offered still? Do you feel like people, when they're like, I want Heather Graham in this movie, I'm thinking of her, like, are they still thinking of you as the actress from, like, an Austin Powers? Or are they being like, I want to offer her something different?
Well, I think one of the great things about The Rest of Us, the movie that I'm in that's coming out right now, is because it's a character that's not my typical thing. And it's more soulful. I think my intelligence, I feel like I get to really play just a real woman who's really intelligent. And I mean, that's one reason why I kind of got into the driver's seat of, you know, writing, directing. I just optioned this book by Leanne Moriarty, and we're hopefully making that into a TV pilot. So I think a lot of actresses are doing that because...
Is she Big Little Lies? Yeah. Well, then, yes.
Yeah, right.
So she's got a slew of books.
Amazing. I know. Every book is optioned by some great actress, because the, yeah. you know, there's not always as much great material for us. We have to make it for ourselves sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the first thing in LA that made you feel like, oh, this is something I sort of want to learn more about?
I went to this female empowerment class because I was thinking, well, this could be a cool movie. I might option this woman's book. And it just was really inspiring to see women just feeling good about themselves. And I formed this group of friends from that class, and we used to get together and wish for things. So we would go to this store in New York, and what's the name of it? But there's this witchcraft store in New York, and you buy candles and you make wishes. Mm-hmm. And so we would all do that. And a lot of amazing things started happening in our lives that we were wishing for. And as each of us would wish for something, we would all wish for that thing for that person and visualize it. And, you know, your intentions are really powerful. I still do it sometimes. It's very fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like affirmations. I don't know if you guys ever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I am, like I have this one, like I write and direct and star in movies that empower women. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's just, or, you know, you do anything that you want. Like I'm making tons of money, stuff like that. And I read them every morning.
With a lot of money.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 I'm doing what I love and making a lot of money.
You guys call me loony, but I'm on her side.
Yeah,
because
there's
the affirmations that you say that kind of like actualize things in yourself. And then there's the ones that you like put all your consciousness together, and I really feel like it can affect the outer world.
Yeah,
maybe
it's your
intention.
Because sometimes you have this negative mindset you don't realize you have, mm-hmm. and you're sort of rewriting it. And a lot of my friends have started doing it, and they said, you know, this is crazy, but this is working.
Yeah.
My girlfriend last night just called me, and she said, I thought this was crazy when you told me to do it, but now half of the things are coming true.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, if anything, I feel like, especially just working in Los Angeles and, you know, how negative so many things can be, it's very helpful to be focused on something that's positive and
affirming. It's so easy to beat up on yourself. Like, mm-hmm. I think, you know, and even growing up religious, it sort of feels like you're supposed to beat up on yourself. You know, I think to kind of go against that programming and go, I'm going to be really nice to myself.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Do you have any wishes you're waiting on right now?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Can't speak them here.
Oh, a lot. No. Yeah. I want to get the TV show that I'm writing to happen. I'm writing actually two different TV shows. I want to direct again. Yeah.
By the way, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it not crazy to suddenly jump into writing? Like, did you feel comfortable just putting pen to page?
Actually, yeah. I have some new friends that are writers, and I just did a read through of this thing that I wrote. And your kind of mind is being blown sometimes when you see something that you wrote, I'm sure, happen, and you're watching people read it. It's really mind blowing.
Did you have to learn the process of screenwriting, like, in the middle of your acting career? Were you already picking up on things?
I mean,
I'm still
learning it. I feel like I read a lot of books. There's a lot of great screenwriting books. Mm-hmm. And I give it to my friends who are writers, and they give me notes. And, you know, it's always a process of learning. But now when I watch things, you know, because you always set up, build, you know, develop, whatever. So you can see, okay, they left a seed of this. So something's going to happen in the second act. In the third act, they're going to pay it off. So you start to understand when you're watching things, you kind of know what's going to happen more.
Mm-hmm.
Because you understand the formula.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's how I picked it up.
I only have the patience to write jokes. So when people can actually write screenplays, I'm blown away.
Yeah. Well, Heather, we want to thank you for being here.
Thanks for being here. Yes, watch the rest of us.
Yeah. We're going to make Keep It listeners go.
It's on iTunes.
Watch the rest of us.
It's in some theaters in 10 cities. But if you want to watch it at home and just be cozy, watch it on iTunes.
Yeah. Cozy speaks to me. Yeah. I have to tell you.
Me too. Home. I mean, I'm in the movie business, but I love watching movies at home.
You're part of the problem, Helen.
Yeah, part of the problem.
Thank you for being here with us, Heather. The Rest of Us premiered February 14th, and so you can see it in select theaters and also watch it on iTunes at home. I was very saddened by the news that former Love Island host Caroline Flack had tragically died over the weekend, and a lot of it was attributed to the sort of pile-on mentality of social media and the press. For those of you who don't know, Caroline was not the host of the currently airing season of Love Island, the South Africa winter season, which is quite boring, if I can say, though I've been told Casa Amor is much better this season. Weeks after a self-admitted dark period in her life where she assaulted her boyfriend and was arrested, she did not come back for this season. But the news of the assault, after not just leading to her dismissal from Love Island, it also led to an onslaught of negative media coverage. which, as we know, in the UK is how they say hello.
Standard practice.
We've heard of you. Shall we ruin your life?
Yes. So they recently chased Harry and Meghan out of the country, and now we have Caroline, who is a confirmed death by suicide. And what's sort of really making a lot of this even weirder is just that this is the third death by suicide from someone involved in Love Island.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Two former contestants, Sophie Graydon and Mike Thelassidis, both took their own lives after appearing on the show.
It's extremely morbid.
Yes. And Sophie's boyfriend took his own life after she died.
Caroline Flack is what they would call in the UK a presenter. Hosting is much more of a serious profession there. Mm-hmm. So this is somebody you'd see all the time. Like a
Sarah on the X Factor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
correct.
Extra Factor, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think she was also on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. So she's just like a mainstay of UK TV.
Mm-hmm. And it's bringing into question this idea of the British press, obviously, and how we attack people, how social media attacks people, and also just this show. Like, should it be canceled? A lot of people are calling for it to be canceled, and it's sort of reminding me of when we were having that conversation in the U.S., you know, with shows like Unreal, right? There's that storyline about one of the contestants dying. And I think it was talking a lot just about the machinations of reality TV and how they can be a toll on people's mental health.
I think about like shows like The Bachelorette that haven't had, that are so, they're so sensational. Like these shows are so easily obsessed over because they are very vain and superficial, but fun. Like I will admit, I love Love Island and I love watching it. Mm-hmm. But then, what kind of culture does that foster? Not just for us, but for the people who are on that show. And Caroline having lost that job after the assault, and it being such a large show, I can't imagine the brunt of that emotionally. Mm-hmm. You know.
And what you also have to remember too is that, as Lewis said, like reality TV in the UK is much different than it is here, because you will see like a Bachelor contestant and maybe you'll see like someone from Big Brother or Survivor on social media or something, and maybe they'll appear in other things. But we're sort of past that big era of where like you became a megastar for being on reality TV in mm-hmm. the US, unless you're like a Real Housewife or something.
Yeah,
right?
Kardashian or whatever.
But
in the UK, like, they are celebrities, and like the press covers them and hounds them like they are Julia Roberts.
Does that speak to like, I mean, I know they have their own celebrities, but that, does that speak to them taking in more American culture, do you think? Or is that just...
No, I think that their culture is just much more concentrated, you know, and it's like they're reporting on the stuff from their own country. What's interesting is that there's been a commentary also from Jameela Jamil, who we have not talked about in the wake of her legendary mess, the fiasco that happened the other week, but I guess we can get into that now. Jamila herself is subject to negative online conspiracy theories herself. I think we know former Gawker writer Tracy Egan Morrissey has sort of been leading a campaign accusing Jamila of Munchausen's
which
by proxy.
Just Munchausen's,
oh,
right?
Just Munchausen. Yeah.
Munchausen by proxy is the thing Patricia Clarkson has in Sharp Object.
The by proxy, how does it qualify, Munchausen's?
You keep treating somebody else as if they're
yeah.
sick.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I love that.
Tracy Morrissey lined up all these interview quotes of Jamila Jamil talking about various illnesses she had, various injuries she's endured, and when you put them all together, they seem
it's a lot.
Highly sensational.
There's that she was deaf until she was 12, and that she's been in multiple car accidents, she's had multiple cancer scares, they've found lumps in her breasts. There's a lot of things that have happened to Jamila. I see where the critique is fair, but I also, unless there's real proof, I don't think it's fair that anyone is looking into her, you know, history like that, her health history.
And what's odd about this too is that it does fit into the Caroline Flack situation, because I mean, Jamila herself started as a presenter in the UK, and now she came over to the US and found fame with The Good Place. It was her first acting role.
Yeah.
Tracy is writing these things on social media and not actually in an article, right? Like they're Instagram stories and tweets, and it's inviting social media to sort of flock and attack Jamila in a way, and it's very hard to take in, and you have to have nuance in this whole conversation because there are very valid reasons to critique Jamila. We didn't really talk about it on the show, but, you know, she had signed up for that HBO Max ballroom show Legendary. It was supposed to be like a judge and an MC is what she was reported as. And a lot of queer people of color took offense to that. And it wasn't because she wasn't queer. It was mostly because she had no involvement in ballroom culture.
Yeah. Well, there's also something specific about ballroom culture. And this goes back to, for instance, the movie Paris is Burning or Madonna's Vogue, where that practice, that dance, whatever, has specifically been used by, taken by white content creators and given to the rest of the world when it was really, you know, a hyper-specific POC expression for so long. So now to add more chapters to that feels like you're dredging up, you know, these old ghosts, basically.
Right. And specifically when you have a show like Pose on FX, you know, like having actual people from the community involved, having actual people from the community writing for it, to see Jamila announced as being involved in the show. And I think, you know, like Megan Thee Stallion is also like supposed to be a judge on the show. It just seems sort of like commodifying a culture to present it to the masses without involvement from anyone who's actually involved in ballroom. And so she had very valid critiques for her involvement. And unfortunately, she felt the need to come out as queer after this. But then she accused the people who were critiquing her of forcing her to come out, right? Mm-hmm. Because she was saying that they said I wasn't queer enough to be involved in the show. Well, surprise, I actually am queer, which wasn't the critique, by the way. So it was appropriate to critique her for being involved in Legendary, and then, unfortunately, she weaponized coming out to make it seem as if she was bullied by queer people of color from the ballroom scene who were like, girl, what are you doing during the show?
Yeah, it just shows the lack of, like, foundational knowledge of what we're trying to talk about with her. We're not accusing you of even queer baiting or coming out as queer. Your timing was horrible. But on top of that, it shows the lapse in your understanding that we are talking about this is a culture that you have nothing to do with. It's not inherently queer. It's inherently their culture, you know?
Right.
And then, unfortunately, that happens to be timed up with the Tracy Morrissey thing now. So there's that question of how can you appropriately critique Jamila without participating in social media pile-on to lead to a Caroline Flack situation.
Yeah.
Which is what Jamila has brought up, you know, comparing the attacks on herself to the attacks on Caroline.
I think, regarding the Jamila controversy, I think something that is strange to me is, and I know she has responded in a somewhat in a responsible way, and I don't mean to say there's a correct way to respond to being called a liar, I guess, but one thing she does is say that she is being gaslit, which I can't stand because I guess gaslit just means any old thing now.
Yeah.
Gaslighting, to reiterate to people who probably don't need to hear it, is I slap Ira in the face and then I say, I didn't slap you in the face again and again until I make him feel like he is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Us questioning really strange, outlandish sounding quotes from Jamila Jamil is not gaslighting.
No.
You know, and I think it's valid because to me, I read these quotes and Munchausen seems like an interesting accusation. What it sounds to me like is compulsive lying.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're asked about something and you embellish the story just because you can't control yourself. That's just what it sounds like to me. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it is. So for her to then respond and say, women aren't taken seriously, whatever. It's like, no, but we're taking your quotes. And also, like, there are strange corroborations occurring, like Mark Ronson talking about how a situation in which she said she was attacked by a bunch of bees, he then, in a separate interview, not knowing what she had said, said they were around two bees. So it sounds like exaggeration. Mm-hmm. I think questioning that is valid.
Yes.
And I'm not saying there aren't people on Twitter hounding her and saying horrible things and, like, you know, she's a woman of color. I'm sure it's as horrible as it can be.
Right.
But I think there is reason to question it.
Right. And unfortunately, this is a situation where these attacks wouldn't be happening on Jamila if people didn't already sort of have a problem with her, right? You know, it's like people who are being really hurtful are people who already were sort of mad at her, right? You sort of see that when someone gets, I don't know, like dragged on social media or Twitter, right? It's like they were dragged because people were already sort of feeling like they wanted to find an excuse to attack that person.
Which is sort of like, I think a lot of people would say that about, for instance, Taylor Swift.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, because it was utterly silent on the Meg Thee Stallion front. Nobody cared that she was potentially going to judge that show. I didn't see as much flack about it as, you know,
yes,
for Jamila.
She also didn't post about it.
That's very true.
Yes.
Just like Jeezy.
Yes, which is to say that I think obviously the Munchausen conversation is very weird, and you know, the sort of shaming of people with invisible disabilities and maybe chronic illness is not the way to go to critique Jamila. I think that if you want to critique her, you can critique the way that she's sort of inhabits the activist space and sort of like takes up the oxygen from other activists, and you know, the way that she really sort of weaponized her coming out to play a victim and saying that sort of the queer people of color and people involved in ballroom who had a right to critique her being involved in Legendary were sort of forcing her to come out when that wasn't the actual conversation. The way that she sort of clapped back at Trace Lissette on Twitter when they were talking about Legendary, those are valid things to critique her about. And I think that we need to get away from this whole like Munchausen conspiracy theory on Instagram.
That said, I do think it's strange that Jamila Jamil's response doesn't contain anything along the lines of, looking back at all these quotes I've given, it does sound like I'm making a bunch of shit up. That's just how it sounds. Again, it's probably, according to her, all those things are true. So I'm just saying, like, to reiterate, guys, I know it sounds crazy, but it's fucking true.
Yeah.
I don't see the harm in that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair. I think you're right, though, that we should be corroborating what she says. I totally agree with that. I think the thing that I critique about Jamila is I usually agree with what she wants and her end goal, but hate the method. The methodology is always extremely violent, and she's going out of her way to, you know, cast a lot of disdain on people who I agree with, but it's just the way she does it. Mm-hmm. So this coming to the fact that she's launching an inquiry into British media and British press, that I can, like, I'm for that. We all have to be.
Yeah. But there's also moments when, like, she's on The View and, like, talks about cancel culture and how, like, it's rampant and out of control. And the way she often does that in a way of the people who call cancel culture everything cancel culture when it isn't. And it's just a lot of always using language that isn't necessary for what she's actually talking about.
There are no two words I hate more than cancel culture. We've talked about this before, but it's, again, consequences culture. I mean, I just think there's a way to engage with most criticism. And I know the line between criticism and straight-up hatefulness on Twitter is often blurred.
Mm-hmm.
That said, it feels like you're invoking the name of some random white man who just can't understand why people don't like Louis C.K., his favorite still.
Right. And, you know, calling the Caroline Flack situation cancel culture is very dumb because it's not cancel culture. It's the culture of a toxic, misogynistic British press that would have driven her to this, you know? And you have people like, what, Piers Morgan posting like, oh, I feel so sorry about this. And it's like, didn't you just say like a bunch of vile things about Meghan Markle? Like, now you care about people's well-being? Like, that's what we should be talking about. And when something happens like Kevin Hart not getting to host the Oscars, and people want to call that cancel culture, which is out of control. As we've said before, that's not canceling. That is a consequence which she also could have just apologized for, and we wouldn't have had to have an entire, you know, winter of talking about Kevin Hart.
I said that cancel culture were my least two favorite words, and then you said Piers Morgan.
And then you said Kevin Hart.
Piers Morgan tweeting upside down from the garbage can in which he lives. Y'all remember that Mean Girls scene based on him.
Upside down. Anyway, when we're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It is Keep It. Lewis, you seem like you are antsy.
I am smiling.
I don't know why you're smiling, bitch.
Well, let me tell you something. You all know I'm obsessed with trivia, and it will come as no surprise to you that I love being right. Billie Eilish's No Time to Die, the theme for the next Bond movie, has come out. A few weeks ago, I said, I don't know if this is the right choice. Love Billie Eilish, love her brother. I called them the ASM Arpenters. Very clever joke of mine. The new song has come out. Guys, it is their sleepiest song yet. We are now 8 years into Bond themes seeming like orchestral Zoloft ads. I just think now we needed the more danceable Bond anthem. I miss when Bond anthem sounded like something you could jet ski to. I miss when they like really led the charge into a movie. Because by the way, James Bond movies used to start with him like skiing off a cliff or something, and the music would match that energy. This song to me feels like something you want to hear while looking for your lost dog in the rain. This is a song I want to hear when I think to myself, Buster's not coming back. Additionally, her vocal... And I know she has a great voice. The vocal to me sounds like a little kid waking up in the night and telling their mom about a bad dream they had. And it isn't lighting me up for an international caper. The self-seriousness is a little too Christopher Nolan era Batman for me. I just miss the joy of Bond.
Well, I will tell you that I think Miss Billie ate this song.
Really?
I do. I mean, I love the belt. At the end, I think that the song is sort of haunting and measured and sort of noir-like. And, like, I will say that I am sick of the sort of self-serious Bonds, and I'm glad this, Daniel Craig's final Bond, I hope that after this we can get back to sort of, like, a fun escapist Bond, as much as I love, like, Casino Royale. And I am a apologist for Quantum of Solace. I will say that I feel that the Pierce Brosnan ones are the ones I miss the most because they were very fun.
Yeah, and he had a sly, I don't want to say camp to him, but snazz. That is what I miss from a James Bond song, snazz.
I don't know. I think that this has the qualities of a very sort of haunting James Bond song.
No,
and I
by
think
the
it
way,
does what Writings on the Wall thought it was doing.
I personally find them very similar. But by the way, did you call that a belt at the end of that song?
Yes.
What it is a light bleat. I say that affectionately. Billie Eilish, one of our leading bleaters.
A Billy Goat, truly.
There we are.
Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing that I think she did at her Oscars performance where I was like, girl, I can't hear what you are singing because you're singing at a fifth below what I think is your range. So I think it's a beautiful song. I ride the line between you guys. It's a beautiful song. I think it has that menacing, scary sort of tonality. But I wanted something to snap to. I wanted something jazzier. I wanted something new out of her instead of something that I like. That feels like a first cut, like a demo of a song.
Well, what are your favorite Bond themes?
Well, the greatest Bond theme of all time is Nobody Does It Better from The Spy Who Loved Me.
I knew you would say Miss Carly Simons.
Can you believe it?
That is in my top five, but it is not the best Bond theme.
Well, Tom York said it's the sexiest song ever written. Have to agree.
All right, Tom York. You don't even like Radiohead.
Moving along. Wait, would you say not GoldenEye? GoldenEye's a great song.
I would say Diamonds Are Forever.
Interesting. Yeah. Oh, okay, I like it.
Miss Bassey.
No, that's what I'm saying. Grandeur. That's what I miss in a song.
She has a point. She's an icon. She's a legend. She was the moment.
Thunderball, I think, is a good song.
Tom Jones.
Yeah.
It's okay.
That's
I'll
what
allow
I'm talking
that.
About. Corniness. Snazz.
Yeah.
I'm gonna lay down the word snazz for everybody. That's what I want. You know, like a kind of gross, luxurious.
Of course. I mean,
sexuality.
I love The World Is Not Enough. I think that's one of Garbage's best songs.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of
halfway between the two worlds I'm talking about.
Okay. You know, I love like Live and Let Die.
Well, get
I
this.
Love this game. I love Skyfall.
I do love Skyfall.
Skyfall's
and that
an amazing
is one, that is one of Lewis's problems. He does not like Skyfall.
Another, I'm going to, again.
Do you hate things
Adele,
that are new?
Adele, the Zoloft egg, singing at us.
He does hate things that
you
are new.
You hate things that are new.
They need sort of the must of Bell's Bookshop.
You need to knock the dust off a song before it's good.
I can't believe how open the library is right now. Shut it down. I also love, I'm a defender of The Living Daylights. I think that's a fun, it's not anthemic, but I think it's a fun song that, again, you can jet ski to, which is the point.
A View to a Kill, though, is great.
I think it's okay. I've never been a Duran Duran person.
I know.
Yeah.
The taste, where is it?
Well, I'm a fan of Grace Jones in that movie. She's one of my favorite.
Mayday, she's great.
Yeah, she's got like that rad trapezoid face.
Okay. I also do like GoldenEye, Miss Tina Turner.
Have you heard the Nicole Scherzinger cover?
I have.
Where she is caterwauling, but I do think it's good.
I love caterwauling Bond covers. Fergie's Live and Let Die cover is a beautiful caterwaul, where she then jumps into the air and is swung around by a rope. I think it might just top her Today Show appearance where she did cartwheels doing Barracuda.
I'm glad we shed a light on that a couple of weeks
did.
Ago.
We did. Yeah, some people discovered that. So if you have not seen Fergie performing Live and Let Die, I believe it was at some like CBS Bond tribute special. It is one of the most insane things I've ever seen.
I do regret the fact that Pink has taken over the stunt space in pop music. Like, that used to be Fergie, and it used to be very DIY.
It's why Fergie's not eating.
That's what I'm saying.
Let Fergie eat. Pink, let her on the trapeze.
Yeah, right. A couple of lessons at the Santa Monica Pier, she'll fit right in.
Anyway, I like the Billy song. And I also would just posit that you like the song a bit better once you get visuals or like a live performance or you see how it fits into the movie.
I'm sure it'll be opening credits that are somber and super sepia. I mean, I don't need to see it, but go on.
All right.
Okay. My keep it this week goes to the whole Wendy Williams situation, but not just what Wendy Williams said, but her apology and then, of course, Twitter's response. So Wendy Williams on her show last week was going on about, and she actually singled out a man in the audience, about riffing on how gay men shouldn't wear women's clothing, just the goofiness of that, in her opinion. And also that she's quoted saying that men shouldn't wear women's clothes because they don't get a menses every 28 days. First off, Wendy Williams, I forget that she has a show other than Ira was just recently on it. I forget that woman still exists. And I thought that she had ratings because TVs would just get left on in nursing homes. Like, I don't understand who is still watching Wendy Williams. But then when she makes that joke, you see the whole audience roar into laughter. Like, nobody's clocking, oh, that's trans exclusionary. Oh, that's extremely cis normative. So I know it's a different world. I know that's not a world that I exist in. And I guess I can't hold Wendy to that critique.
Daytime TV is a whole other world, by the way, because, or even you probably get this on like late night with like Kimmel things. I feel like the people who go to specifically sit in the audience for TV shows are a whole other breed.
Someone who's free at 3 o'clock?
Yes.
That's what that is.
Well, I think they're very specifically a lot of the time out of towners.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Getting like a taste of Hollywood, so they go to see Wendy or Ellen.
And so they will cackle at the Wendy Williams thing because it's like, they're not interacting with, like, queer trans people.
Ever.
Ever. Yeah.
Yeah. So that happens. That ordeal goes down. Of course, Twitter has a backlash. And then Wendy posts, like, a 3-minute video of her sitting in a robe while she's, like, just gotten her makeup done, giving a long and very measured, sad apology. Like, it sounded very earnest. But at no point does she go... No point does she clear up the actual meat of the issue, which is that she's excluding trans people and then redefining what... We have, as a society, has decided what woman means. Do
you know I love my gays. Come on.
Always have.
You know I love my gays. That's my Wendy Williams.
It's also just, what the hell is even remotely remarkable about a guy wearing a dress at this point?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's like saying don't put plants in that corner of the room. Why?
Right.
Yeah. It's like, yeah.
Things occur. Who cares?
Yeah. Very 1980s.
Especially when she'll just like roll out in some Skechers and like a fur coat sometimes. It's like, sis, let them do fashion.
And then, of course, Twitter was irritated, as Twitter is known to do. And I feel like I'm happy she apologized, but it wasn't sincere enough. Like, it didn't actually handle what she was apologizing for. She just knew she had to say sorry.
What's wild is that Wendy sort of has these moments that I feel like happen in the culture all the time. You're either sharing a meme of her from the show, of her doing something that's sort of wild, or she has a controversy like this. It was because right before I went on the show, that was the week that she had made fun of Joaquin Phoenix's
for his cleft lip. Oh, my gosh.
And so
She's just like,
what are we doing, girl?
It's like a cycle of learning, but then she still keeps her show but doesn't learn anything.
Yes.
And of course, recently, Wendy Williams made a very strange, callous joke about the death of Drew Carey's ex-fiance, who died because her ex-boyfriend was arrested and charged with her murder after she was found unresponsive below a balcony with injuries consistent with a fall. Wendy Williams, in talking about this story, made a come on down joke.
What?
About her. And so, I mean...
Is she Vincent Price?
Yeah.
Literally a ghoul at times.
There are times when I guess you're just talking on stage and you have to fill the space with something and you say the wrong thing. But truly, I mean, in recent history, I can't think of a wronger thing to say.
Yeah. Well, it's speaking of that, it's like what's also sort of weird about the Wendy Williams show is when you watch it, her segments of the hot topics, right? It's not really like enough topics to fill time often. Like a topic will come up and it'll be something that she wants to talk about that maybe she might not even know anything about. I remember like when Phoebe Waller-Bridge won her Emmys, she was like, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, anybody see Fleabag? I don't know what that is, but congrats to you, girl. Or like she'll talk about like how she is trying to watch like Power, but like Stars isn't working or something, and like she'll just be like having conversations with like the audience or her producer who's off camera, and just sort of like filling time,
that
just shooting the shit on her show, and it's so wild to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you have that sort of atmosphere, you can say wild things, and that's live. It's not a podcast.
You know
when
what,
we shoot the shit, we can cut it.
And we do cut a lot of things.
Yes. Like Love It cuts half of his show.
Well, I mean, you know, it's interesting, though, because that is, to me, what remains novel about Wendy Williams is, okay, even though we all live on Twitter where everyone's just saying the first thing that comes to mind, there is something about television and people responding to pop culture, like daily pop culture, with frankness and honesty that still feels rare to me. You know what I mean? I still think of when people are reporting on entertainment, just this feeling of gushy enthusiasm for everything, the way you think of normal red carpet reportage or like the E! Network. Like no one's ever really saying like, thought that movie sucked. You know what I mean? They're like, mm-hmm. They're always excited for the new project and they can't really be honest about it. Mm-hmm. Where, so Wendy Williams, I think, still fills a void in an interesting way where she's just like, glancing at pop culture news and being like, who cares, occasionally, which mm-hmm. unfortunately is still refreshing in some regards,
yeah.
But also sets the groundwork for her saying stupid things every once in a while. I don't mean to excuse any of those comments whatsoever, by
no,
the way.
Not at all. I didn't even know about the Drew Carey thing. And
yeah.
That is like ghoulish. I said it. It's ghoulish.
And the audience didn't respond at all, at least at that
at
point.
At least good,
So
yeah.
In case if you're trying to gain back some faith in Wendy Williams' audience in the studio.
Now I can comfortably go to her show. Thank
That's
you.
Right.
Thank you so much.
The audience was like, ooh, girl, you told her. Anyway, my keep it is to a specific person in a show that I'm currently obsessed with. It is McMillions, and it is on HBO. And if you don't know about McMillions, it is based on basically the story that nobody really won the McDonald's Monopoly game for several years. There was a small circle of scammers who, for more than a decade, were swindling McDonald's out of the prize money. And I think if you've been to McDonald's, you know that like every year they sort of had that Monopoly game where you get pieces and then you sort of put it around a Monopoly board and like they had prizes like $1 million or like a new car or like a home.
When I was a kid, I was obsessed with McDonald's
Same.
Monopoly because it was so collectible and like big colorful board and stuff. And I thought, this is the only way I will ever win a Sea-Doo. And I need that.
You get two little pieces with one medium drink. It was amazing.
Yes. And also, like, they would bait you so well because they would give you Park Place. And so you're like, well, here I am, one piece away from Boardwalk. And there's like two Boardwalks printed in the entire universe.
Yeah.
And it's, and I feel like I always only ever won like a free cheeseburger or fries.
Right.
Yeah. I don't want to destroy the show, but I want to know, it shows the actual scammers that ended up winning?
Yes, it shows the investigation of the scammers. It goes from the FBI first finding out that there might be a scam, and from what I've seen so far, convincing McDonald's to run the game another time so that they could find a winner, and then one of the agents, who my keep it is to, Doug Matthews, he goes undercover as the director as they go to this person's house and sort of like get him to talk about how he won the game and whatever. So they have this footage, and it's fascinating just sort of like seeing everything sort of unfold. There have been three episodes so far, and it really is unfolding everything in this sort of like crime that goes through so many people in a really interesting way. So I really do love the show. I will just say that FBI agent Doug Matthews, who is on the show, is doing too goddamn much.
Oh, as like as a talking head?
Yes, as a talking head. And he's the one who went undercover. He was so excited to go undercover. He's just talking so excitedly about this case. And obviously he's wild, and it's why we're watching the show. But just thinking in the context of like an overzealous FBI agent as a fun character is sort of wild to me. You know, like once you're done watching the show and you peel back, like this man should maybe not have his job. You know, it's just like when they meet the McDonald's executives to talk about how they're being scammed, like he was like, this is boring to me. I came in a gold suit.
Oh, so he's
like an eccentric. He's an eccentric who's sort of like really enjoying his moment in this documentary. And I'm like,
you got to play it cool, like the blowjob guy in the Firefest documentary. Yes. Slow roll us into your crazy story. Don't oversell it.
Oh, but also imagine the insanity you'd be pushed to if you're an FBI agent and you're only working on the McDonald's case.
Yeah.
You know?
I just need to play Cash Dolls doing too much for him, because I'm like, you are doing too much in the show. The show is very good. I'm gripped. But he's so fucking extra.
Yeah.
It's a light keep it, but like.
Yeah.
I feel it. I feel
chill, baby.
And how many? We have a couple more episodes.
There's three so far.
God. All right. I'm going to catch up on that.
If you tell Doug he's doing too much, he'll tell you, you ain't doing enough.
Lyrics.
There you go.
Anyway, thank you so much to Heather Graham for joining us this week. That's our show. Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Rustin is our producer. It's Caroline, like the princess, the one you don't care about. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.